Our country is in serious trouble. We don't have victories anymore. We used to have victories, but we don't have them.
In June last year, the real estate developer and reality TV star Donald Trump travelled down the escalator of his New York skyscraper to announce his candidacy for President of the United States. It wasn't so much a message of hope and change. It was more like a dire warning.
When was the last time anybody saw us beating, let's say, China in a trade deal? They kill us. I beat China all the time. All the time. When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us, at our stupidity. The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems.
Aside from the incendiary comments, there were several remarkable things about Trump's speech. Firstly, he was attacking the orthodoxy of free trade, a position that both major parties have supported for years. And secondly, Trump is speaking without a teleprompter or notes, using direct emotive language, a million miles away from the flat, precise, scripted language of most politicians. And there's something else. Trump divides up the world into winners and losers. If someone wins, then someone else has to lose. It's a zero-sum game. Most American politicians accept that America has prospered in the world by persuading other nations, like Australia, that American prosperity, rightly or wrongly, is good for the rest of the world. But Trump is different. Towards the end of his speech, he blamed America's problems on losers within the government.
We have losers. We have losers. We have people that don't have it.
Losers who might even be traitors as well.
We have people that are morally corrupt. We have people that are selling this country down the drain.
Trump seems to defy the laws of political gravity in America. He throws out inflammatory statements that are verifiably false. And he does it all the time. When he gets picked up on those statements, he'll shrug and say something like,
"Now, I don't know. What do I know about it? All I know is what's on the internet, and I don't like to see a man drag."
So how has Donald Trump managed to go so far? What kind of powerful feelings has he tapped into? And in Donald Trump's world of winners and losers, of hardworking Americans and foreign freeloaders, where does Australia fit into that picture? Today you'll hear from US journalist John Nichols and Tom Switzer from the US Studies Center. But I want to start with John, who is on the campaign trail right now in Madison, Wisconsin. John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for the progressive news magazine The Nation. John Nichols has covered many presidential campaigns, but I'm guessing he's never seen one quite like this one. Hi, John.
Hello, it's good to be with you.
You've been at Trump rallies. What's the atmosphere at a Trump rally like?
Very different from most political rallies. And it's different for two reasons. One, Trump has never run for public office before. So he is essentially running as who he is, a celebrity, a very wealthy television personality. And a tremendous number of the people who come to his rallies have never been to a rally before. Donald Trump has touched something in a great many Americans who are incredibly upset with the current circumstance. So much so that it has drawn them into the political process, and not just into it as voters, but as highly energized, agitated political participants. His political rallies have an edge to them. There are often confrontations between the crowd and journalists. There are confrontations between the crowd and the occasional protester who gets in. There are confrontations outside the rallies. And there is also a fascination. I mean, people hang on every word, not because every word that Trump says is fascinating or not because every word he says is particularly newsworthy, but because you never know when he is going to say something that you've simply never heard at a political rally in modern times. Just the other day, when everybody expected him to be talking about Hillary Clinton's emails and some controversies that had been in play around them, he started talking about how Saddam Hussein actually did a good job dealing with terrorists. which I can tell you has not been said at many American rallies.
No, I don't think it has it? Last time we spoke, John, I think it was just after Barack Obama had been elected president. Yeah. And Barack Obama was able to speak in that campaign to really highly energized crowds. Is it a similar thing to the way Obama was able to energize and excite crowds? Is that what Trump's doing, a similar thing, or is it quite different?
Absolutely different. 100% different. Obama's crowds were much younger. They were very diverse. And frankly, people were quite proud of the youth and diversity. They liked the notion that this was a sort of fresh, energetic campaign that seemed to be moving America forward historically. But it was very upbeat. Also, Obama, whether you like him or dislike him, agree with him or disagree with him, is a classic orator. His speech at a rally would begin very, very easygoing introductions, light references, and then he would sort of take off into this often very structured, intentional address that really led the crowd in a coherent path toward a soaring end that brought everybody to their feet and had great excitement and energy. Trump doesn't do that. Trump will come in and he'll often... It'll almost sound like he's rambling for the first maybe 15, 20 minutes. With Trump, it's much more like a conversation with someone you know who is very open, very ready to talk about whatever comes up. And then if incidents happen at the rally, if there's a dispute or if there's, you know, some scuffle on the side, he'll talk about that from the stage. It's entirely focused on Trump and on kind of what he might do that's unexpected that day. But I will also say the one thing that's important, the people who go to his rallies are deeply, deeply committed to him. They're very excited. Not all of them. There's some people who go just as tourists who want to hear it. But a real chunk of them, they're very much ready to kind of go where he says they should go.
In the last 30 years, America has been going through great extremes of income inequality. Real wages haven't risen at all. There's often a whole class of working poor in the United States. And it's sometimes said that Trump's followers are made up of this group of the downtrodden, the people who are suffering the sting of globalization, John. But then I look at the crowd and they look pretty well dressed to me. What's going on there?
Your observation's a good one. This is the best way to understand it. And polling shows that Trump voters tend to be middle class. Even in some states, they've been a little wealthier than some Republican voters. So they're not the downtrodden necessarily. But I think they are the people who feel a great fear of being disenfranchised. They fear a moment of globalization, deindustrialization, rapid automation of our industries, and a circumstance where the jobs that they have don't necessarily look like they're going to last. And so these may be people who don't have, you know, the highest educational achievement. Doesn't mean they're not smart. They may be quite bright. But as young folks, maybe in a working class background, they went into an industry, they went into a job that they thought was going to be permanent, that they thought was going to give them a great deal of security as it had their parents and grandparents. Suddenly they see radical changes taking place. They don't understand why all of them are taking place. They're unsettled by layoffs, by plant closings, by all sorts of other economic twists and turns. And then along comes Donald Trump. And Donald Trump says two things. One, he's going to make America great again. The operative word in that sentence is again. He's going to take you back to something that made sense to you. And secondly, he says that there are people who are different than you who are for some reason to blame for your circumstance. It might be an immigrant, might be a refugee, might be somebody who doesn't believe religiously in the same way that you do, but somehow this different person has made your life worse. That person, that type of person, they're your real problem. He goes to one group of people who feel like they might become downtrodden, and he tells them that their problems are created by the other folks who are downtrodden. At the same time, he says the elites care more about those other folks than they do about you.
We know what is the kind of thing he's calling for at the moment. He's anti-free trade. He's mm-hmm. anti-immigration. He wants the United States military to withdraw from the world and let other America's allies pay for their own defense. How long has he held these views, John? Is this newly found or has he had them for a while?
He has been all over the place. I mean, he is a candidate who has had pretty much every position on every issue. Usually with a political candidate, if a candidate says something, then you go back in the record and you show, well, he said the opposite thing, not 20 years ago, but a year ago. That's embarrassing to the candidate. Trump doesn't care. I mean, and you know, more power to him in this regard. He just says, you know, I learned a little bit more, you know. And, but he suggests that he was a kind of a steady opponent of the Iraq War, that he was against it from the start, always critical of it. Well, people have gone back and found evidence that suggests that he wasn't all that steady. He has historically been thought of as a donor, somebody who gave money often to Democrats. He had pretty close relationship with a lot of Democrats, including Bill and Hillary Clinton. He's been all over the political sphere. What's fascinating about it is that that doesn't bother his supporters much, because he says something that's very interesting and I'm afraid makes a lot of sense to a lot of Americans. And that is, I only gave money to these Democrats, or I only hung out with them because that's what you have to do to get ahead in business. That, you know, you got to spread the money around, make contributions, you know, hang out with these folks, and then they'll help you do development.
That's true, isn't it?
You know what? It's like the first time I heard him say it, I didn't know quite how to respond, because of course there was a lot of truth to it. And this was during the Republican debates, and other Republicans would attack him for having made campaign contributions to Democrats, and he would turn to him and he'd say, well, you called me and asked me for money. Literally, he would say this to him, and he says, and I wrote you a check, and he'd remember, I wrote you $15,000, or I gave you this much money. And at the end of the day, he, in a weird kind of way, insulated himself by saying, yeah, I bought influence. The initial and still core argument for Donald Trump, especially if you talk to people who are supporting him for president, is that he just knows how to do business, that he's good at it, that he, you know, he knows how to do a deal. He wrote this book called The Art of a Deal, that he knows how to negotiate. He had a TV show in which he was always negotiating and hiring and firing people, and that he has a set of skills that would make him a better president than others who've been president, or others who might be president.
I think one of the things that attracts attention to Donald Trump is he seems to admire violence quite a lot, and has expressed his admiration for ruthless actions by authoritarian leaders like Saddam Hussein, Vladimir Putin. What kind of latitude, John, would a President Trump have to crush losers and traitors and people he deems to be of that ilk?
Well, you've just gotten into a really interesting area here. America has a distinctive political system, very different than Australia. We elect a powerful president who is the most known figure in our government. The Congress and the courts are supposed to be able to check and balance the president, and there's no doubt that in a properly functioning system, that's the case. But the presidency has, even to this day, after more than 200 years, a great deal of ill-defined power. And presidents have launched wars without congressional authorization. Presidents have cracked down on dissent. We remember in America the circumstance of Japanese Americans who were put in internment camps during World War II. So we have circumstances in America where we've seen presidents and presidential administrations go to what historically we think of as extremes. And this is what I think unsettles a great many people, including many conservative Republicans, who struggle with the question of just exactly what might Donald Trump do as president. He has shown very little interest in Congress. He'll go up every once in a while and meet with them, but, you know, it's usually very contentious. He has said things about the courts, which are quite unsettling. He's attacked judges because of their ethnic background, suggested perhaps even that he might have a problem with Muslim judges because he's been often said things that were very controversial as regards Muslims. So across the board, there is this sense that if he was president of the United States, we don't know how Trump would relate to the other branches of government or to the traditional definition of the office, which, again, as I said before, is still, after all this time, after all this history, somewhat ill-defined.
I don't know about you, but I see a very, like a weird kind of primatical sort of dynamic with Trump. It's like watching a chimp enclosure or something. There's the alpha chimp. And eventually, you know, they have tussles with other aggressive males like the Chris Christies of this world. But eventually they prevail over that. And then those rivals then become acolytes and stand next to them. Are you seeing that, John, or is this just me fantasizing?
No, you definitely have a future in American punditry. there's no doubt. Jump the sea there. The Christie thing, I think you really kind of nailed it there. And he was such a bombastic figure as governor of New Jersey and as a candidate for president. And yet, when Christie went down politically and he endorsed Trump, he's ended up in this terrible situation where Trump will be talking about somebody who's not doing their job right or something like that. And he'll say something like, well, even Chris Christie does a better job than that. And Christie will be on stage with him, right? And it's sort of this demeaning thing. And, you know, Christie's got a smile there. And then there was this incredible report, I think in The New Yorker recently, that suggested that, you know, Christie sort of like shows up at Trump events when he's not even invited. That he'll run errands, you know, like if Trump wants something, I'll go grab that for you, right? And it is a very, very unsettling, you know, kind of restructuring of Christie's image to such an extent. A reporter called up Christie's office and asked about some of these things. And the quote back or the end of the story was that Mr. Christie's spokeswoman said he was not a manservant.
It's come to this. The governor of New Jersey has to insist that he's not a manservant.
It's pretty bad.
This brings us to the Republican Party as a whole, John. During the primary campaign, when Donald Trump was debating against people like Marco Rubio, Chris Christie, and Jeb Bush, he said this about the Iraq War.
Obviously, the war in Iraq was a big, fat mistake, all right? We spent $2 trillion, thousands of lives. We don't even have it. Iran is taking over Iraq with the second largest oil reserves in the world. Obviously, it was a mistake. So George Bush made a mistake. We can make mistakes, but that one was a beauty.
When he said that on the debate stage, I thought the other Republicans' heads were going to explode when he said that. John, is that heresy? What's happening in the Republican Party? And what does it mean when Donald Trump is saying things like the Iraq War was a big fat mistake to the other Republicans, including Jeb Bush on stage?
Well, it's sort of this Donald Trump thing. He kind of breaks all the rules, right? And then what you realize right after he breaks the rule is that there wasn't much of a reason for the rule. The fact is that most Republicans know that the Iraq War was a mistake, or at least that it was incredibly problematic and that it has blown up on our country in a host of ways and caused a lot of long-term trauma and difficulty. To have the front runner for the nomination saying that, it does kind of blow apart. It blows things apart and it breaks the rules. But this is the key to Trump. In fact, I would argue this is the most important thing to understand about the guy. When he decided to run for president, I think he took a very serious look at the Republican Party. And he said, this is how the Republican Party operates. It has an elite of candidates and consultants who have for a long time told their base of voters, this is what you need to believe. You need to believe that these wars are necessary. You need to believe that these free trade policies are necessary. You need to believe all of these things. And if you do that and you elect us, then we'll appoint conservative judges to the Supreme Court and we'll try to keep, you know, laws against lesbians and gays getting married and, you know, some other things like that. But that you have to believe all this other stuff to get the kind of core conservative, social conservative things you want. What Trump came along and said is, you don't have to believe those things. You don't have to believe that the war in Iraq was a good idea. You don't have to believe free trade was a good idea. You don't have to believe that we have to get along with China. You don't have to believe all sorts of things that they've been told to believe. And you know what the weird thing is? That the base of the Republican Party, an awful lot of voters, and we see this in many states, they felt sort of freed.
And never believed any of that, perhaps.
Yeah, they were sort of grudgingly dragged along. And then they're sort of like, well, yeah, I didn't really like that Iraq war all that much. And so it proved to be political genius, frankly, because he essentially said the emperor has no clothes. And it turned out a lot of people in the crowd believed that the emperor did have no clothes.
Hillary Clinton has a strong lead in the polls against Trump, and it's very early days yet, though. She seems to be on track, if things go as they are, to win a strong victory against Trump, perhaps even a massive landslide. Can you see any kind of foreseeable set of circumstances whereby Trump wins?
Sure. I mean, it's always possible. This is volatile politics in a volatile year. The likelihood and the best bet at every turn is that, just about every turn, is that Hillary Clinton will win. And she is helped a great deal by Donald Trump, because he has said things about major constituencies in America, including Latinos, that appear, if the polling is accurate, to have energized people not merely to vote against him, but to really come out and vote in big numbers. And so she has some tremendous advantages, and there's no doubt of that. But here's the Trump trick, if you will. One of the reasons that he so viciously attacks his opponents is to make his opponents unattractive in the eyes of their own supporters. He doesn't attack people for their weaknesses. He attacks them often for their strengths. He goes for, you know, the things that might attract somebody to a candidate that might make somebody vote for him. He did this with all of his Republican opponents. And presumably he will, I think, try to make people just so disgusted with the whole presidential race that turnout is reduced. If turnout is reduced, and I'm not saying this is going to happen, but obviously this is the strategy, then if he focuses a tremendous amount of his energy on attracting blue-collar, working-class voters who are very, very frightened by the process of globalization, by free trade, and by the deindustrialization of many of our cities, there is a chance he could potentially find a way through. I don't think that will happen. I'm not predicting that, but I also always counsel, when I'm talking to folks who just completely write Trump off and say, oh, he doesn't have a chance, that in fact, history in America tells us that when we have a low turnout election with a candidate who has an energized base of supporters, that candidate can sometimes achieve victories that are unexpected. And so we should watch that.
I think that's a novel campaign strategy. Go hard and go disgusting. I think that's something new, isn't it?
Not really.
No, I suppose not. Trump dropped out of the campaign trail for a little while to spend a week in Scotland opening a
yes.
new golf course resort there. There is a school of thought that says that if Trump looks like he's going to lose in a landslide, he might just quit and walk away rather than have his brand damaged by a terrible and humiliating defeat. What do you think, John?
Well, that is, you are playing with some really interesting terrain. This is where it gets fun. I can tell you that the single best question I have been asked during the entire 2016 campaign was at an event I was speaking at. And a woman got up and she said, look, I don't know much about politics, but I'm very, very interested in who Trump's vice presidential candidate will be, because he's quit everything he's ever done. So I think the vice presidency with Trump could be a big deal.
Well, just taking a step back at the moment, it seems like there's lots of disruption going on in the what we'd call the Anglosphere at the moment, in the Western democracies at the moment. Taking a step back, John, in general though, is America going through some kind of wrenching transition right now?
Look, most of our media does a lousy job of covering what's actually happening in that confluence of business and politics and society where real change occurs. It's hard to cover that, and it's hard to keep ahead of it. But we are going through a digital revolution and an automation revolution that has changed almost everything in our lives. We live for our phones now. We can't get our children away from their telephones, right? We're talking about having driverless cars and driverless trucks, which are going to put a lot of people out of work. You know, we're changing so many things. And in this process of globalization, where businesses move from country to country, jobs move from country to country, I think people feel very overwhelmed and often very uncertain about their own futures. I think that's where you can connect the Brexit vote in the United Kingdom with the Trump phenomenon in America. If you take a deep breath and step back, you may realize it has less to do with personalities and parties and more to do with great big changes that most people are conscious of, but that our media and our politics hasn't figured out how to discuss. And so you end up with a Brexit vote. You end up with a Donald Trump. These sort of unexpected phenomena politically that may not really be about what the Brexit vote was on or even what Trump is talking about, but may be about people struggling to find some reaction to changes which are overwhelming them.
Great to speak with you, John, and thank you for your insights. Good luck on the campaign trail. It's time to put on the helmet and the flak jacket and go back out there and do your job, I suppose. It's been wonderful to speak with you, John. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
I appreciate it, too. I'll be stronger knowing that Australians are following me.
Today on Conversations, the possibility of President Trump. What kind of powerful political emotions has he drawn on or stirred up? And what would a President Trump mean for a country like Australia and the world? Tom Switzer has been a senior fellow lecturer and tutor with the United States Study Centre at the University of Sydney since 2009. Tom's also a presenter of Between the Lines on ABC Radio National. He's worked at the Washington-based American Enterprise Institute, written for the Wall Street Journal, New York Times and Foreign Affairs. He was born in Dallas, Texas, but he barracks for Australia in the Olympics, and that's what counts. Hello, Tom.
G'day, Richard. Great to be with you.
What happened when you wrote, as a conservative, an article that was critical of Donald Trump? What kind of fan mail did you get?
Well, I wrote a series of articles for the Sydney Morning Herald late last year, just pointing out that he was a very divisive figure and his erratic behaviour, lack of core governing philosophy, would mean that if he were nominated as a Republican candidate, he would get annihilated at the next general election. And this generated a lot of nasty feedback from both Americans and, believe it or not, Australians.
What were they telling you?
Well, they said that you're going to have egg on your face because he will not only win the nomination, but he will also win the White House, that there is a hankering in America and the outside world for someone who tells it like it is. And the problem with journalists and academics, and I'm one of them, is that, we live in an ivory tower.
There's no shame in not predicting Donald Trump winning the nomination. I don't think any journalist, or not many journalists at all, predicted that Trump would come out on top and win the Republican nomination.
I mean, I feel a bit bad about it now because I think clearly what I've noticed over the last few years is the United States is in a pretty foul mood. The American people are in a foul mood. They think their country's heading in the wrong direction. And Trump presses the buttons of a lot of those folks who feel marginalised.
John Nichols was just saying that he thinks Trump's followers are made up of people who are not the downtrodden, not yet anyway. They're people who are reasonably well-to-do, but the kind of economy they live in is threatened by globalization, by the digital age, by automation, and there's anxiety amongst his followers that they might be next up. They might be thrown onto the heap of the new poor or something. Is that your assessment?
Well, I think there's no question that there is a certain segment of Trump supporters like those that John Nichols identifies, but there are also a lot of lower middle class, working class folks who feel disoriented by the pace of socioeconomic change. They feel that they're losers of globalisation, and they feel that the country they've known and loved over the last few decades is no more, that they lose wars in the Middle East, that unemployment is rising in their industries, that there's been wage stagnation, even wage decline. And at the same time, you're seeing these widening levels of income inequality. These are the very reasons, by the way, why the socialist candidate Bernie Sanders gave Hillary Clinton a real run for her money during her contest. And I think this explains why Trump has done very well.
There are pretty good reasons for that feeling of economic insecurity. But what about race as a factor as well? I mean, the demographics of the United States is changing. You're seeing a situation where white Americans are, for the first time, I think perhaps this election or maybe the next one, not going to form a majority of more than 50% of the voting public. Do you think there's a bit of anxiety there, the idea of a black man in the White House, a feeling that they've lost at a racial level their control of the country?
Well, if you look at all the Trump rallies, you don't see too many Hispanics or African Americans or Asian Americans. They are predominantly white. And I think this gets to a bigger issue here. What you're seeing here is demography very much moving against older, whiter Americans. the Republican Party, in a way, is in a bit of a bind. If you just look at the basic statistics, I mean, you sort of hinted at it there. The minority share of the national vote is steadily rising, you know, especially among Hispanic Americans. And at the same time, you have whiter voters and older voters, and their share of the vote is declining. And so those trends self-evidently help the Democrats. And I think you're starting to see this in even conservative states like Florida and Texas, and New Mexico, Arizona. It's conceivable that in the next 10 years, the Hispanic share of the vote will be so high that it really will hurt Republicans if they don't change their position on things like immigration.
Conservative commentators in the United States, and these are people you know, who are furious and outraged and upset about the rise of Donald Trump. Do they think the party is being hijacked, or is the rise of Trump the kind of logical next step for the direction the Republican Party's already been going in, Tom?
Opinion varies. E.J. Dionne, who's no stranger to RN, he's written a book in the last 6 months called How the Right Went Wrong. And his argument is that what we're seeing here with Trump is a logical rightward shift in American politics since Barry Goldwater. Barry Goldwater was a conservative insurgent candidate who won the Republican presidential nomination in controversial circumstances in 1964. He subsequently got smashed by Lyndon Johnson in that year's general election. But since Goldwater, the centre of political gravity in the Republican Party has moved to the right. We saw the Reagan movement in the late 70s and throughout the 1980s. Then you saw the Newt Gingrich conservative revolutionary, a bit of an oxymoron there, conservative revolutionary movement in the 1990s. And then it culminated with not just George W. Bush in the 2000s, but the Tea Party, which wanted to slash and burn the federal government. And now you're seeing it here with Trump. I don't think, for what it's worth, Richard, that's a satisfactory explanation for the rise of Trump. I think that Trump, as Will Brooks, Wall Street Journal editorial page, and other mainstream conservatives have identified over the last 12 months, I think Trump wants to bring down the house of Goldwater and Reagan. Trump represents a repudiation of the modern conservative tradition in the United States.
Would it be a bit like, given that American parties are more porous than Australian parties, would it be a bit like if somehow Pauline Hanson's One Nation suddenly overnight took over the Liberal Party in Australia? Is that what it would be like? Like, you know, your lifelong Libs who would turn around and suddenly see the army of Pauline Hanson's followers suddenly in the party and having majority control of it?
Yeah, I think that's plausible. I think what you're seeing here with Trump, I think a better analogy than Hanson, because Hanson really represents 5, maybe 10% of the national vote. I think the better analogy are those European populist and nationalist insurgency movements that are helping bring down established parties, or at least threaten them.
What, like the National Front, you mean?
France, this is Marine Le Pen's party. Yeah. I think she stands a very decent chance of winning the elections next May, because she's going to splinter the conservative vote. She may even win some socialists who are railing against globalisation. But you're seeing it all across Northern Europe, Western Europe, Eastern Europe and Southern Europe. There's a feeling that the political elites in these countries, the political establishment, have lost their legitimacy, and there's a genuine search for radical alternatives.
How prone has the Republican Party been in the last several decades to sort of living in a kind of closed information sphere? I mean, there's a rejection of empirical science on climate, on economics, on a whole range of issues. You saw this moment when Trump called a lot of the other Republican candidates on stage and told them what I think nearly everyone in America already knows, that the Iraq War was a fiasco,
yes.
And that look of absolute panic on their faces. I mean, is there a feeling that in some ways, and every once in a while, Trump is sort of smashing into that closed information sphere of the Republican Party and telling them unwelcome truths?
That's an interesting point, Richard. I think there's something to be said for that. Remember, there were 17 presidential candidates in the Republican nomination process. The Republican Party chose the least conservative candidate, and that was Donald Trump. And
What do you mean by that?
Well, he takes issue with the Republican Party as we have known it for the last four decades, the party since the Reagan ascendancy. He's not necessarily a supply-side free marketeer. He doesn't place a huge emphasis on tax cuts to grow the economy. He doesn't support entitlement reforms like many free market Republicans do on Capitol Hill. So his agenda is in complete contrast to, say, Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House. And on foreign policy, as you say, and trade policy, he takes a completely different view. He's a protectionist. He's opposed to a lot of these trade deals that both Republicans and Democrats have supported over the last few decades. And moreover, as you suggested, in South Carolina in the primary there, on the eve of the primary, he doesn't believe that America should be the global policeman. I mean, it's really quite astonishing. And yet the party's on the cusp of pre-selecting a guy who doesn't believe America should be the world policeman. We haven't seen a Republican candidate like that at this level since well before the war.
Trump's kind of flip-flopped on quite a few issues, on abortion, on which party he supports. He's gone back and forth on quite a few issues here with this. But one thing he has been consistent with since the 1990s is this thing you're talking about, which is that America is spending too much propping up defence resources of its allies, Japan and South Korea, and maybe even Australia, I don't know. What would it mean if the United States decided to repudiate its security agreements with a country like Australia? You know, we'd be paying quite a bit more in tax, wouldn't we, Tom?
We would. We'd be spending more than the 2% of the GDP that we really need to be spending. But look, my sense is, and from everything I know, and I do have a reliable source in the Trump team, believe it or not, who does make it clear to me that the alliance, the US alliance with Australia that has been in place since 1951, the end of World War II and the height of the Cold War, that's not the kind of alliance that Trump would want to jettison. He'd be more likely to jettison NATO than he would Australia, or even the relationships between Washington and Tokyo and South Korea and the other US treaty ally partners in East Asia.
Yeah, well, he's looking at Japan and he's looking at South Korea, and he's saying, why are we spending all this money on propping up their defence when they're using their budget to support their industry, create cheap cars that then flood the American markets?
Well, in fairness, he hasn't spelled out his policy in great detail.
Well, Matt, I've probably been a bit more specific than Trump has been in that
moment. Well, no, to be fair, he has given an interview to, I think it was Anderson Cooper on CNN in early April, when he was pressed on this very point. And he was asked whether he favoured Japan and South Korea developing nuclear weapons of their own. And he said he wouldn't mind if they did, and that's probably only a matter of time before they did anyway. But this is a very unorthodox position for a Republican or a Democrat politician to take.
China is behaving much more assertively in the region at the moment, creating little defence outposts on little atolls in the middle of the South China Sea, which is a source of concern for a lot of America's allies in the region, the Philippines and Singapore and other nations as well. How would they be viewing the prospect of a President Trump, or even the fact that a Trump has gone this far making these kinds of policies this popular, Tom?
Well, again, it's not altogether clear because he hasn't spelled out his views. And there are, crudely putting it, there are two ways of looking at China. There's one view that engagement makes sense because we have to recognise that China is a rising great power and they're entitled to a sphere of influence like other great powers in world history. I can imagine Trump cutting China some slack in that regard. But then on the other hand, there's another school of thought that says that China could represent the next regional, perhaps even global hegemon in the region or in the world. And to the extent that that is true, America needs to draw a line in the sand, or in this case, the water, with freedom of navigation exercises in the South China Sea. The interesting thing about China's rise is that most of the countries in the region strongly support America's freedom of navigation attempts to keep China honest. But none of those countries appear willing to actually launch freedom of navigation exercises within that 12 nautical mile zone. It's not clear where Trump stands. It's clear where Hillary Clinton stands. She's shoulder to shoulder with the Obama administration and the Republican Congress. But again, this guy's a bit of a loose cannon. It's not clear what he stands for on this issue.
What would happen if he put up a great big trade barrier to China, for example? I mean, at the moment, low-income Americans buy their stuff from Walmart, which is super discounted, it pays super low wages, all of those things. That whole little economic ecosystem would be completely disrupted, wouldn't it?
Trump consistently says on the campaign trail that he would put a 40-45% tariff on Chinese goods.
Now,
That's pretty high price. Now, of course, the flip side to that, of course, is that it would mean that the consumer goods for Americans would be a lot higher than they are now. And it would also probably spark global economic volatility. And moreover, it would go against the WTO trade norms. And this is really the heart of the matter when it comes to Donald Trump. He doesn't subscribe to the international norms that we've known over the last, in the post-war decade. He believes that America, if it's losing trade disputes with competitors like China, it should make those competitors pay a price.
How weird is this conversation we're having, Tom? I mean, we are having this conversation because we need to ask these questions at the moment, but we're talking about the star of The Apprentice here. I'm sort of at a bit of a loss. I think we're all a bit of a loss here, aren't we, to sort of how seriously do you have to take this kind of a phenomenon? And, you know, there is the possibility that if Trump's worried that he's going to lose badly, he might just walk away from the presidential election so he doesn't damage his brand as a loser.
Well, look, I think, you know, I've made it clear I'm not a Trump supporter, but I think the reality is he's clearly tapping into a widespread sense of anxiety in the United States. In the same way that Le Pen is tapping into a widespread sense of anxiety in France. And you're seeing this mindset play out all across Europe. You're not seeing it play out here in Australia. I think we're immune to Trumpism at this stage. And I'll say that for two reasons. One is we've had pretty good levels of economic growth. We haven't had a recession in this country for 25 years, Richard. The Americans have had three downturns during that period. We haven't really paid a price with globalisation. If anything, economic reform driven by the Hawke-Keating tariff cuts and deregulation of the financial markets, that's made us a more competitive country. It hasn't necessarily worked like that for a lot of Americans displaced by globalisation. And Trump is talking to those folks. So on the one hand, I agree, it's hard to believe that a rude and crude buffoon who, to put it mildly and politely, is incapable of understatement, he's nevertheless resonating with significant segments of Americans, particularly those in Rust Belt states in the United States like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Ohio. And if he brings out the vote in these states, these folks who are displaced by globalization, the folks who don't usually vote, if they turn out on polling day and Hillary Clinton's vote is not so high, then he would have a decent chance of winning those states, and that could give him a chance to win the election. I don't think he will, but you can't write off that prospect.
We're in a really weird position in a minute. America's in a really weird position at the moment. There's a vacant Supreme Court seat that won't be filled till after the election. A whole year there's going to be a vacant seat.
Right.
Several times the Congress, Republican-controlled Congress, has instituted a government shutdown. There's constant attacks on President Obama's very legitimacy as president, led by Trump in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like America's unraveling a bit. And I wonder if this is going to be like a period like the 1970s, where America unraveled, late 60s, early 70s, where America unraveled and sort of brought itself back together again. Or is it more like the 1930s, where something darker might be afoot?
Well, look, I think in light of what's happened in Dallas in the last week, my birthplace, as well as Baton Rouge, these are the incidents regarding police brutality of African-American innocent people, and then, of course, the terrible slaying of those five policemen in Dallas. I think, in a way, the better analogy would be, and I know you've studied this period, Richard, the period in the late 1960s, early 1970s, back then you had disruptions to the civic and social order, and that overwhelmed America's political leadership. And at the time you had various individuals like Malcolm X, the Black Panthers, they were saying that police brutality against black people justified a response. But there are some clear differences. I mean, I don't think, well, for starters, we don't have the Vietnam War, which caused a lot of the dissent. But also, I don't think the United States is in the grip of a new era of Jim Crow racialism. We know more about police brutality thanks to mobile phone cameras. And the US court system has been dealing systematically with these charges of violent bias brought by prosecutors against law officers. And, of course, that many of these police officers themselves are non-white. I mean, I think that America is a more polarising nation than it was when President Obama came to power, but I think the trends are the same. I mean, if you go back to the period after the Iraq invasion, polls have consistently said over the last 12 or so years that Americans think their country's heading in the wrong direction, that America's best days are behind it, and subsequently it's become a more polarising nation, and it's going to be increasingly difficult to govern in Washington. But time and again, the critics have given America the kiss of death. You know, after the Civil War in the 1860s, the Great Depression in the late 20s and throughout the 1930s, Vietnam, Watergate. And every time the critics gave the United States, old Uncle Sam, the kiss of death, it was mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. She revived and bounced back with tremendous force. Question now is, does America have the capacity to bounce back from this terrible setback in the aftermath of Iraq and these polarizing problems we've been discussing? I'm not so confident. I mean, there are some reasons to be upbeat. You have to remember the United States is still the greatest economic power, military power. Demography and fertility are on its side. Higher education, still the envy of the world. But nevertheless, I'm not so sure Americans believe in their country the way they did before.
Will we see a lot of Republicans endorsing Hillary Clinton for presidency of the United States?
I wouldn't say a lot, but you'll certainly see many high-profile Republican-leaning commentators in the press. But the Republican Party, I think, is on the verge of splintering. And that's what Trump represents. He challenges the old conservative way of governance. He wants to stand Ronald Reagan on his head. He never says that, because Reagan is such a leading figure among most Republicans. But Trump, and everything he represents, whether it be on trade, foreign policy, economics, even social and cultural issues, he is not one of us, so to speak.
So do you think the Republican Party could actually suffer some kind of permanent fissure over Trump and the accumulation of Trump supporters within the Republican
Party? Yeah, these things take time. It wouldn't just happen in one election or even two. But I can see we're at the early stages where perhaps both parties, both Republicans and Democrats, are showing signs of splintering. We saw this in the Democratic race.
Yeah, that was my next question. Yeah. Bernie Sanders has similarly been able to generate a whole lot of political passion from outsiders.
You and I, like most seasoned observers of American politics, have been flabbergasted that Donald Trump has done so well. But who in their right mind 12 months ago would have predicted that a 74-year-old socialist, who wasn't even a member of the Democrats, would give Hillary Clinton, the queen of the liberal establishment, a real run for her money?
If there is a kind of a massive realignment of American politics, do you think it might take the same form as the Brexit vote in the UK, where on one party, probably the Democrats, will contain the coastal, urbanised, cosmopolitan population that's comfortable with globalism, rich and poor, and then you'll have the interior of the United and south of the United States working in what's called the old economy of things, if you like, that will be poorer than the other group and will gravitate towards the Republican Party.
That is conceivable. The problem is that the Republican Party consists of two significant wings. There's the so-called Reagan Democrats, or the white working class and lower middle class, and a lot of these folks are attracted to Donald Trump. But then there's the business constituency, the Wall Street constituency, the pro-big business, the free market constituency. They're not necessarily the same thing, but the folks who actually like lowering the size and the scope of the federal government. And it's not altogether clear where the Republican establishment will eventually side with. At this stage, they still believe in the party of Reagan. But if Trump is successful and he challenges the old Reaganite way of doing things, then the circumstances can change. On the Democrat front, I think it's more likely the Democrats will be more the coastal, big city, socially progressive party, and the old working class will start to fray, and they may be more attracted to the Trump-like figures in the Republican movement. But we could be on the cusp of a real realignment of American politics, which would not be completely out of character with American history. There have been many times in America's past where there have been political realignments that have shaken up the two-party system.
There's another constituency in the Republican Party, and that's evangelical Christians. Now, I was a little confused how evangelical Christians could possibly support a creature like Donald Trump. You know, he's had several wives, admitted to infidelities without much apology in there. He calls the second book of Corinthians, Corinthians 2, like it's the sequel, you know? You know, Corinthians rises again, that kind of thing. How they could possibly support Trump?
I can't explain that. There are a lot of things about Trump I just can't explain. But one of the intriguing side issues to what you're saying is that Mitt Romney, there's a lot of scepticism about Mitt Romney when he was the 2012 Republican presidential candidate. A lot of evangelicals were very nervous. They were more nervous about Romney than they were about Trump. Now, Romney, remember, was a Mormon. But I feel sorry for Romney. He had this wonderful, quirky line when he ran for president the first time in 2008. He was subjected to all this heat for being a Mormon. And he was on the same stage as Rudy Giuliani, Fred Thompson, John McCain, I think Newt Gingrich, other Republicans who've been married and divorced several times. And Romney countered accusations that as a Mormon, he supported polygamy by reminding everyone that he was the only candidate on the stage who only had one wife. And yet the evangelicals still didn't like him.
So go figure. I was reading an article about Trump and I found this great quote. And it's a really prescient quote from a political thinker called Richard Rorty. Now, this was made 20 years ago, well, nearly 20 years ago, in 1997. That long ago, during the Clinton era, this was. And this is what Richard Rorty said back in 1997. Members of labour unions and unorganised, unskilled workers will sooner or later realise that their government is not even trying to prevent wages from sinking or to prevent jobs from being exported. Around the same time, they will realise that suburban white-collar workers, themselves desperately afraid of being downsized, are not going to let themselves be taxed to provide social benefits for anyone else. At that point, he says, something will crack. The non-suburban electorate will decide that the system has failed and start looking around for a strong man to vote for, someone willing to assure them that, once he is elected, the smug bureaucrats, tricky lawyers, overpaid bond salesmen and postmodernist professors will no longer be calling the shots. It's pretty amazingly prescient, isn't it?
Well, indeed, it is prescient. And as I say, all these folks who are disoriented by the pace of radical socioeconomic change, who've been displaced by globalisation, they are attracted to radical alternatives to the status quo. And the Republican Party, for the last 40 years, as Sam Tannenhouse in the New York Times, one of the leading authorities in America on conservatism, he said the GOP has made a fetish of ideological rectitude at the expense of meeting the needs of voters. And it's Trump, and Tannenhouse is no supporter of Trump, but it's Trump who is finally addressing these real economic needs. In a way, that's precisely what this academic said 20 years ago.
Great to speak with you, Tom. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Richard.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Tom Switzer is a lecturer at the US Studies Centre at Sydney University, and of course he's also the presenter of Between the Lines on ABC Radio. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. I'm Richard Feidler.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.